Macmillan Audio presents If We Were Villains by M.L. Rio. Read for you by Robert Petkoff.
For the many weird and wonderful thespians whom I have had the good fortune to call my friends, I promise this is not about you. Act 1. Prologue. I sit with my wrists cuffed to the table and I think, but that I am forbid to tell the secrets of my prison house, I could a tale unfold whose lightest word would harrow up thy soul. The guard stands by the door watching me like he's waiting for something to happen. Enter Joseph Colborne. He is a graying man now, almost 50. It's a surprise every few weeks to see how much he's aged, and he's aged a little more every few weeks for 10 years. He sits across from me, folds his hands, and says, "Oliver." "Joe." "Heard the parole hearing went your way. Congratulations." "I'd thank you if I thought you meant it." "You know I don't think you belong in here." "That doesn't mean you think I'm innocent." "No." He sighs, checks his watch, the same one he's worn since we met, as if I'm boring him. "So why are you here?" I ask. "Same fortnightly reason?" His eyebrows make a flat black line.
"You would say fucking fortnight.
You can take the boy out of the theater or something like that." He shakes his head, simultaneously amused and annoyed. "Well?" I say.
"Well what?"
"The gallows does well, but how does it well? It does well to those that do ill," I reply, determined to deserve his annoyance. "Why are you here? You should know by now I'm not going to tell you anything."
"Actually," he says, "this time I think I might be able to change your mind."
I sit up straighter in my chair. "How?"
"I'm leaving the force. Sold out. Took a job in private security. Got my kids' education to think about."
For a moment, I simply stare at him. Colborne, I always imagined, would have to be put down like a savage old dog before he'd leave the chief's office. "How's that supposed to persuade me?" I ask.
"Anything you say will be strictly off the record."
"Then why bother?" He sighs again, and all the lines on his face deepen.
"Oliver, I don't care about doling out punishment. Not anymore. Someone served the time, and we rarely get that much satisfaction in our line of work. But I don't want to hang up my hat and waste the next 10 years wondering what really happened 10 years ago."
I say nothing at first. I like the idea, but don't trust it. I glance around at the grim cinder blocks, the tiny black video cameras that peer down from every corner, the guard with his jutting underbite. I close my eyes, inhale deeply, and imagine the freshness of Illinois springtime. What it will be like to step outside after gasping on stale prison air for a third of my life. When I exhale, I open my eyes and Colborne is watching me closely. "I don't know," I say. "I'm getting out of here one way or the other. I don't want to risk coming back. Seems safer to let sleeping dogs lie." His fingers drum restlessly on the table.
"Tell me something," he says. "Do you ever lie in your cell staring up at the ceiling wondering how you wound up in here, and you can't sleep because you can't stop thinking about that day?"
"Every night," I say, without sarcasm. "But here's the difference, Joe. For you, it was just one day, then business as usual. For us, it was one day and every single day that came after. I lean forward on my elbows so my face is only a few inches from his, so he hears every word when I lower my voice. It must eat you alive, not knowing. Not knowing who, not knowing how, not knowing why. But you didn't know him. He wears a strange, queasy expression now, as if I've become unspeakably ugly and awful to look at.
You've kept your secrets all this time, he says. It would drive anyone else crazy. Why do it?
I wanted to.
Do you still?
My heart feels heavy in my chest. Secrets carry weight like lead. I lean back. The guard watches impassively as if we are two strangers talking in another language, our conversation distant and insignificant. I think of the others. Once upon a time, us. We did wicked things, but they were necessary too, or so it seemed. Looking back years later, I'm not so sure they were, and now I wonder, could I explain it all to Colborne? The little twists and turns and final exodus? I study his blank, open face, the gray eyes winged now by crow's feet, but clear and bright as they have always been. All right, I say. I'll tell you a story, but you have to understand a few things. Colborne is motionless.
I'm listening.
First, I'll start talking after I get out of here, not before. Second, this can't come back to me or anyone else. No double jeopardy. And last, it's not an apology. I wait for some response from him, a nod or a word, but he only blinks at me, silent and stoic as a sphinx. Well, Joe, I say, can you live with that? He gives me a cold sliver of a smile.
Yes, I think I can.
Scene 1. The time, September 1997, my fourth and final year at Delacour Classical Conservatory. The place, Broadwater, Illinois, a small town of almost no consequence. It had been a warm autumn so far. Enter the players. There were seven of us then. Seven bright young things with wide, precious futures ahead of us, though we saw no farther than the books in front of our faces. We were always surrounded by books and words and poetry, all the fierce passions of the world bound in leather and vellum. I blame this in part for what happened. The castle library was an airy octagonal room walled with bookshelves, crowded with sumptuous old furniture and kept drowsily warm by a monumental fireplace that burned almost constantly, regardless of the temperature outside. The clock on the mantel struck 12, and we stirred one by one like seven statues coming to life.
"'Tis now dead midnight," Richard said.
He sat in the largest armchair like it was a throne, long legs outstretched, feet propped up on the grate. 3 years of playing kings and conquerors had taught him to sit that way in every chair, on or off stage.
"And by 8 o'clock tomorrow we must be made immortal."
He closed his book with a snap. Meredith, curled like a cat on one end of the sofa, while I sprawled like a dog on the other, toyed with one strand of her long auburn hair as she asked, "Where are you going?" "Richard."
"Weary with toil, I haste me to my bed."
"Philippa." "Spare us."
"Richard." "Early morning and all that."
"Alexander." He says, as if he's concerned. Wren, sitting cross-legged on a cushion by the hearth and oblivious to the others' bickering, said, "Have you all picked your pieces? I can't decide."
"Me."
"What about Isabella? Your Isabella's excellent." Meredith. "Measure's a comedy, you fool. We're auditioning for Caesar." "I don't know why we bother auditioning at all." Alexander, slumped over the table, wallowing in the darkness at the back of the room, reached for the bottle of scotch at his elbow. He refilled his glass, took one huge gulp, and grimaced at the rest of us. I could cast the whole bastarding thing right now. How? I asked. I never know where I'll end up.
That's because they always cast you last, Richard said, as whatever happens to be left over.
Tisk, tisk, Meredith said. Are we Richard tonight, or are we Dick? Ignore him, Oliver, James said. He sat by himself in the farthest corner, loath to look up from his notebook. He had always been the most serious student in our year, which probably explained why he was also the best actor, and certainly why no one resented him for it. There. Alexander had unfolded a wad of $10 bills from his pocket and was counting them out on the table. That's $50.
For what? Meredith said. You want a lap dance?
Why, are you practicing for after graduation?
Bite me.
Ask nicely.
$50 for what?
I asked, keen to interrupt. Meredith and Alexander had by far the foulest mouths among the seven of us, and took a perverse kind of pride in out-cussing each other. If we let them, they'd go at it all night. Alexander tapped the stack of tens with one long finger.
I bet $50 I can call the cast list right now and not be wrong.
Five of us exchanged curious glances. Wren was still frowning into the fireplace.
All right, let's hear it, Philippa said with a wan little sigh, as though her curiosity had gotten the better of her.
Alexander pushed his unruly black curls back from his face and said, Well, obviously Richard will be Caesar.
Because we all secretly want to kill him? James asked.
Richard arched one dark eyebrow.
Et tu, Brute?
Sic semper tyrannis, James said, and drew the tip of his pen across his throat like a dagger. Thus always to tyrants.
Alexander gestured from one of them to the other.
Exactly, he said. James will be Brutus because he's always the good guy, and I'll be Cassius because I'm always the bad guy. Richard and Wren can't be married because that would be gross, so she'll be Portia, Meredith will be Calpurnia, and Pip, you'll end up in drag again.
Philippa, more difficult to cast than Meredith, the femme fatale, or Wren, the ingenue, was obliged to cross-dress whenever we ran out of good female parts, a common occurrence in the Shakespearean theater.
Kill me, she said.
Wait, I said, effectively proving Richard's hypothesis that I was a permanent leftover in the casting process. Where does that leave me? Alexander studied me with narrowed eyes, running his tongue across his teeth.
Probably as Octavius, he decided. They won't make you Antony, no offense, but you're just not conspicuous enough. It'll be that insufferable third year. What's his name?
Philippa.
Richard the Second?
Richard.
Hilarious. No. Colin Highland.
Spectacular.
I looked down at the text of Pericles I was scanning for what felt like the 100th time. Only half as talented as any of the rest of them, I seemed doomed to always play supporting roles in someone else's story. Far too many times I had asked myself whether art was imitating life or if it was the other way around.
Alexander, $50 on that exact casting. Any takers?
Meredith.
No.
Alexander.
Why not?
Philippa.
Because that's precisely what'll happen.
Richard chuckled and climbed out of his chair.
One can only hope.
He started toward the door and leaned over to pinch James's cheek on his way out.
Good night, sweet prince.
James smacked Richard's hand away with his notebook, then made a show of disappearing behind it again. Meredith echoed Richard's laugh and said,
Thou art as hot a jack in thy mood as any in Italy.
A plague of both your houses, James muttered.
Meredith stretched with a small, suggestive groan and pushed herself off the couch.
"Coming to bed?" Richard asked.
"Yes, Alexander's made all this work seem rather pointless." She left her books scattered on the low table in front of the fire, her empty wine glass with them, a crescent of lipstick clinging to the rim. "Good night," she said to the room at large. "Godspeed." They disappeared down the hall together. I rubbed my eyes, which were beginning to burn from the effort of reading for hours on end. Wren tossed her book backward over her head, and I started as it landed beside me on the couch. Wren:
"To hell with it."
Alexander:
"That's the spirit."
Wren:
"I'll just do Isabella."
Philippa:
"Just go to bed."
Wren stood slowly, blinking the vestigial light of the fire out of her eyes.
"I'll probably lie awake all night reciting lines," she said.
"Want to come out for a smoke?"
Alexander had finished his whiskey, again, and was rolling a spliff on the table.
"Might help you relax."
"No, thank you,"
she said, drifting out into the hall.
"Good night."
"Suit yourself."
Alexander pushed his chair back, spliff poking out of one corner of his mouth.
"Oliver?"
"If I help you smoke that, I'll wake up with no voice tomorrow."
"Pip?"
She nudged her glasses up into her hair and coughed softly, testing her throat.
"God, you're a terrible influence," she said.
"Fine."
He nodded, already halfway out of the room, hands buried deep in his pockets. I watched them go, a little jealously, then slumped down against the arm of the couch. I struggled to focus on my text, which was so aggressively annotated that it was barely legible anymore.
Pericles:
"Antioch, farewell. For wisdom sees those men blush not in actions blacker than the night, will shew no course to keep them from the light. One sin I know another doth provoke, murder's as near to lust as flame to smoke." I murmured the last two lines under my breath. I knew them by heart, had known them for months, but the fear that I would forget a word or phrase halfway through my audition gnawed at me anyway. I glanced across the room at James and said, "Do you ever wonder if Shakespeare knew these speeches half as well as we do?" He withdrew from whatever verse he was reading, looked up, and said,
"Constantly."
I cracked a smile, vindicated just enough.
"Well, I give up. I'm not actually getting anything done."
He checked his watch.
"No, I don't think I am either."
I heaved myself off the sofa and followed James up the spiral stairs to the bedroom we shared, which was directly over the library, the highest of three rooms in a little stone column commonly referred to as the tower. It had once been used only as an attic, but the cobwebs and clutter had been cleared away to make room for more students in the late 70s. 20 years later, it housed James and me, two beds with blue Delacour bedspreads, two monstrous old wardrobes, and a pair of mismatched bookshelves too ugly for the library.
"Do you think it'll fall out how Alexander says?" I asked.
James pulled his shirt off, mussing his hair in the process.
"If you ask me, it's too predictable."
"When have they ever surprised us?"
"Frederick surprises me all the time," he said.
"But Gwendolyn will have the final say. She always does. If it were up to her, Richard would play all of the men and half the women."
"Which would leave Meredith playing the other half."
He pressed the heels of his palms against his eyes.
"When do you read tomorrow?"
"Right after Richard. Philip is after me."
"And I'm after her. God, I feel bad for her."
"Yeah," I said. "It's a wonder she hasn't dropped out." James frowned thoughtfully as he wriggled out of his jeans.
"Well, she's a bit more resilient than the rest of us. Maybe that's why Gwendolyn torments her."
"Just because she can take it?" I said, discarding my own clothes in a pile on the floor.
"That's cruel."
He shrugged.
"That's Gwendolyn."
If I had my way, I'd turn it all upside down, I said. Make Alexander Caesar and have Richard play Cassius instead. He folded his comforter back and asked, Am I still Brutus? No. I tossed a sock at him. You're Antony. For once, I get to be the lead. Your time will come to be the tragic hero. Just wait for spring. I glanced up from the drawer I was pawing through. Has Frederick been telling you secrets again? He lay down and folded his hands behind his head. He may have mentioned Troilus and Cressida. He has this fantastic idea to do it as a battle of the sexes. All the Trojans men, all the Greeks women. That's insane. Why? That play is as much about sex as it is about war, he said. Gwendolen will want Richard to be Hector, of course, but that makes you Troilus. Why on earth wouldn't you be Troilus? He shifted, arched his back. I may have mentioned that I'd like to have a little more variety on my resume. I stared at him, unsure if I should be insulted. Don't look at me like that, he said, a low note of reproach in his voice. He agreed we all need to break out of our boxes. I'm tired of playing fools in love like Troilus, and I'm sure you're tired of always playing the sidekick. I flopped on my bed on my back. Yeah, you're probably right. For a moment, I let my thoughts wander, and then I breathed out a laugh. Something funny? James asked as he reached over to turn out the light. You'll have to be Cressida, I told him. You're the only one of us pretty enough. We lay there laughing in the dark until we dropped off to sleep and slept deeply, with no way of knowing that the curtain was about to rise on a drama of our own invention. Scene 2. Delacour Classical Conservatory occupied 20 or so acres of land on the eastern edge of Broadwater, and the borders of the two so often overlapped that it was difficult to tell where campus ended and town began. The first years were housed in a cluster of brick buildings in town, while the second and third years were crowded together at the hall, and the handful of fourth years were tucked away in odd, isolated corners of campus or left to fend for themselves. We, the fourth-year theater students, lived on the far side of the lake in what was whimsically called the castle. Not really a castle, but a small stone building that happened to have one turret, originally the groundskeeper's quarters. Delacour Hall, a sprawling red-brick mansion, looked down a steep hill to the dark, flat water of the lake. Dormitories and the ballroom were on the fourth and fifth floors, classrooms and offices on the second and third, while the ground floor was divided into refectory, music hall, library, and conservatory. A chapel jutted off the west end of the building, and sometime in the 1960s, the Archibald Delacour Fine Arts Building, generally referred to as the Fab for more than one reason, was erected on the east side of the hall, a small courtyard and honeycomb of corbelled walkways wedged between them. The Fab was home to the Archibald Delacour Theater and the rehearsal hall, and ergo was where we spent most of our time. At 8 in the morning on the first day of classes, it was exceptionally quiet. Richard and I walked from the castle together, though I wasn't due to audition for another half hour. How do you feel? He asked as we climbed the steep hill to the lawn. Nervous, like I always am. The number of auditions under my belt didn't matter. The anxiety never really left me. No need to be, he said. You're never as dreadful as you think you are. Just don't shift your weight too much. You're most interesting when you stand still. I frowned at him. How do you mean? I mean when you forget you're on stage and forget to be nervous. You really listen to other actors, really hear the words like it's the first time you've heard them. It's wonderful to work with and marvelous to watch. He shook his head at the look of consternation on my face. I shouldn't have told you. Don't get self-conscious. He clapped one huge hand on my shoulder, and I was so distracted I pitched forward, my fingertips brushing the dewy grass. Richard's booming laugh echoed in the morning air, and he grabbed my arm to help me find my balance. "See?" he said. "Keep your feet planted and you'll be fine."
"You suck," I said, but with a grudging smirk. Richard had that effect on people.
As soon as we reached the fab, he gave me another cheery smack on the back and disappeared into the rehearsal hall. I paced back and forth along the crossover, puzzling over what he had said and repeating Pericles to myself like I was saying a string of Hail Marys. Our first semester auditions determined which parts we would play in our fall production. That year, Julius Caesar. Tragedies and histories were reserved for the fourth years, while the third years were relegated to romance and comedy, and all the bit parts were played by the second years. First years were left to work backstage, slog through general education, and wonder what the hell they'd gotten themselves into. Each year, students whose performance was deemed unsatisfactory were cut from the program, often as many as half. To survive until fourth year was proof of either talent or dumb luck. In my case, the latter. Class photos from the past 50 years hung in two neat rows along the wall in the crossover. Ours was the last, and certainly the sexiest, a publicity photo from the previous year's production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. We looked younger. It was Frederick's idea to do Midsummer as a pajama party. James and I, Lysander and Demetrius, respectively, wore striped boxers and white undershirts and stood glaring at each other, with Wren, Hermia, in a short pink nightgown, trapped between us. Philippa stood on my left in Helena's longer blue nightdress, clutching the pillow she and Wren had walloped each other with in Act 3. In the middle of the photo, Alexander and Meredith were wrapped around each other like a pair of snakes. He, a sinister and seductive Oberon in slinky silk bathrobe, she, a voluptuous Titania in revealing black lace. But Richard was the most arresting. Standing among the other rude mechanicals in clownish flannel pajamas, enormous donkey ears protruding from his thick black hair. His Nick Bottom was aggressive, unpredictable, and totally deranged. He terrorized the fairies, tormented the other players, scared the hell out of the audience, and, as always, stole the show. The seven of us had survived three yearly purges because we were each somehow indispensable to the playing company. In the course of 4 years, we were transformed from a rabble of bit players to a small, meticulously trained dramatic troupe. Some of our theatrical assets were obvious. Richard was pure power, 6'3" and carved from concrete, with sharp black eyes and a thrilling bass voice that flattened every other sound in a room. He played warlords and despots and anyone else the audience needed to be impressed by or afraid of. Meredith was uniquely designed for seduction, a walking daydream of supple curves and skin like satin. But there was something merciless about her sex appeal. You watched her when she moved, whatever else was happening, and whether you wanted to or not. She and Richard had been together in every typical sense of the word since the spring semester of our second year. Wren, Richard's cousin, though you never would have guessed it by looking at them, was the ingenue, the girl next door, a waifish thing with corn silk hair and round china doll eyes. Alexander was our resident villain, thin and wiry, with long dark curls and sharp canine teeth that made him look like a vampire when he smiled. Philippa and I were more difficult to categorize. She was tall, olive-skinned, vaguely boyish. There was something cool and chameleonic about her that made her equally convincing as Horatio or Emilia. I, on the other hand, was average in every imaginable way. Not especially handsome, not especially talented, not especially good at anything, but just good enough at everything that I could pick up whatever slack the others left. I was convinced I had survived the third year purge because James would have been moody and sullen without me. Fate had dealt us a good hand in our first year when he and I found ourselves squashed together in a tiny room on the top floor of the dormitories. When I'd first opened our door, he looked up from the bag he was unpacking, held out his hand, and said, "Here comes Sir Oliver. You are well met, I hope." He was the sort of actor everyone fell in love with as soon as he stepped on stage, and I was no exception. Even in our early days at Delacour, I was protective and even possessive of him when other friends came too close and threatened to usurp my place as best, an event as rare as a meteor shower. Some people saw me as Gwendolyn always cast me, simply the loyal sidekick. James was so quintessentially a hero that this didn't bother me. He was the handsomest of us. Meredith once compared him to a Disney prince, but more charming than that was his childlike depth of feeling, on and off stage. For 3 years, I enjoyed the overflow of his popularity and admired him intensely, without jealousy, even though he was Frederick's obvious favorite in much the same way that Richard was Gwendolyn's. Of course, James did not have Richard's ego or temper and was liked by everyone, while Richard was hated and loved with equal ferocity. It was customary for us to watch whichever audition followed our own. Performing unobserved was compensation for performing first, and I paced restlessly along the crossover, wishing that James could have been my audience. Even when he didn't mean to be, Richard was an intimidating onlooker. I could hear his voice from the rehearsal hall ringing off the walls. "Richard.
Therefore take heed how you imporn our person, how you awake our sleeping sword of war. We charge you in the name of God, take heed. For never two such kingdoms did contend without much fall of blood, whose guiltless drops are every one a woe, a sore complaint against him whose wrongs give edge unto the swords that make such waste in brief mortality."
I'd seen him do the same speech twice before, but that made it no less impressive. At precisely 8:30, the door to the rehearsal hall creaked open. Frederick's familiar face, wizened and droll, appeared in the gap.
"Oliver, we're ready for you now."
"Great." My pulse quickened, a flutter like little bird wings trapped between my lungs.
I felt small walking into the rehearsal hall, as I always did. It was a cavernous room with a high-vaulted ceiling and long windows that gazed out on the grounds. Blue velvet curtains hung on either side of them, hems gathered in dusty piles on the hardwood floor. My voice echoed as I said, "Good morning, Gwendolyn." The red-headed stick-figure woman behind the casting table glanced up at me, her presence in the room disproportionately enormous. Bold pink lipstick and a paisley headscarf made her look like some sort of gypsy. She wiggled her fingers in greeting, and the bangles on her wrist rattled. Richard sat in the chair to the left of the table, arms folded, watching me with a comfortable smile. I was not leading man material, and therefore didn't qualify as competition. I flashed him a grin, and then tried to ignore him.
"Oliver," Gwendolyn said, "lovely to see you. Have you lost weight?"
"Gained it, actually," I said, my face going warm. When I left for summer break, she had advised me to bulk up. I spent hours at the gym every day of June, July, and August, hoping to impress her.
"Hmm,"
she said, gaze descending slowly from the top of my head to my feet with the cold scrutiny of a slave trader at auction.
"Well, shall we get started?"
"Sure." Remembering Richard's advice, I straightened my feet on the floor and resolved not to move without reason. Frederick eased back into his seat beside Gwendolyn, removed his glasses, and wiped the lenses on the hem of his shirt.
"What do you have for us today?" he asked.
"Pericles," I said. He had suggested it the previous term. He gave me a small, conspiratorial nod.
"Perfect. Whenever you're ready."
Scene 3. We spent the rest of the day at the bar, a dimly lit, wood-paneled hole in the wall where the staff knew most Delacour students by name, accepted as many fake IDs as real ones, and didn't seem to find it odd that some of us had been 21 for 3 years. The fourth years had finished auditioning by noon, but Frederick and Gwendolyn had 42 other students to see, and, allowing for lunch and dinner breaks and deliberation, the cast lists probably wouldn't be posted until midnight. Six of us sat in our usual booth at the Boar's Head, as clever a joke as Broadwater was capable of, collecting empty glasses on the table. We all drank beer except Meredith, who was mainlining vodka sodas, and Alexander, who drank scotch and drank it neat. It was Wren's turn to wait at the fab for the cast list to go up. The rest of us had taken ours already, and if she reappeared empty-handed, it would be back to the beginning of the rotation. The sun had set hours before, but we weren't finished dissecting our auditions.
"I fucked it up completely," Meredith said, for what might have been the 10th time. "I said dismember instead of dissemble, like an absolute idiot."
"In the context of that speech, it hardly matters," Alexander said wearily. "Gwendolyn probably didn't notice, and Frederick probably didn't care." Before Meredith could reply, Wren burst in from outside, a single sheet of paper clutched in her hand.
"It's up," she said,
and we all leapt to our feet. Richard guided her to the table, sat her down, and snatched the list. She had already seen it and suffered herself to be shunted into a corner while the rest of us bent over the table. After a few moments' silent, furious reading, Alexander sprang up again.
"What did I tell you?"
He slapped the list, pointed at Wren, and shouted,
"Barkeep, let me buy this lady a drink!"
"Sit down, Alexander, you preposterous ass,"
Philippa said, grabbing his elbow to pull him back into the booth.
"You weren't all right."
"I was so."
"No. Oliver's playing Octavius, but he's also playing Casca."
"Am I?"
I had stopped reading once I saw the line drawn between my name and Octavius's and leaned in for a second look.
"Yeah, and I've got three. Decius Brutus, Lucilius, and Titinius."
She offered a stoic smile to me, her fellow persona non grata.
"Why would they do that?"
Meredith asked, stirring what remained of her vodka and sucking the last drops off her little red straw.
"They've got plenty of second years to use." "But the third years are doing shrew," Wren said. "They'll need all the bodies they can get."
"Colin's going to be a busy boy," James remarked. "Look, they've got him playing Antony and Tranio."
"They did the same thing to me last year," Richard said, as if we didn't all already know. "Nick Bottom with you all, and the player king with the fourth years. I was in rehearsal 8 hours a day."
Sometimes third years were chosen to take a role in a fourth-year cast that couldn't be trusted to a second year. It meant classes from 8 until 3, then rehearsal with one cast until 6:30, and rehearsal with another cast until 11. Secretly, I didn't envy Richard or Colin.
"Not this time," Alexander said with a wicked little smirk. "You'll only have rehearsal half the week. You die in Act 3.
"I'll drink to that," Philippa said.
"How many fond fools serve mad jealousy?" Richard declared.
"Oh, shut up," Wren said. "Get us another round and perhaps we'll put up with you a little while longer."
He rose from his seat and said,
"I would give all my fame for a pot of ale,"
as he made his way to the bar. Philippa shook her head and said,
"If only."
Scene 4. We left our things in the castle and ran wildly through the trees, down the hillside stairs to the edge of the lake. We laughed and shouted at one another, sure we wouldn't be heard and too tipsy to care if we were. The dock stretched out into the water from the boathouse, where a collection of useless old tools crumbled and rusted. There hadn't been a boat kept on the south side of the lake since they turned the castle into student housing.
We spent many warm nights and some of the cold ones smoking and drinking on the dock, dangling our feet over the water. Meredith, who was in by far the best shape and much faster than the rest of us, ran with her hair snapping like a flag behind her and got there first. She stopped and draped her arms over her head, a pale stripe of her back visible above her waistband.
"How sweet the moonlight sleeps upon this bank!"
She turned and grabbed both my hands because I was closest.
"Here will we sit and let the sounds of music creep in our ears. Soft stillness and the night become the touches of sweet harmony."
I pretended to protest as she dragged me to the end of the dock, and the others tumbled down the stairs to join us one by one. Alexander brought up the rear, wheezing.
"Let's go skinny dipping," Meredith said, already kicking her shoes off. "I haven't been swimming all summer."
"The chariest maid is prodigal enough," James warned, "if she unmasks her beauty to the moon."
"For God's sake, James, you're no fun."
She swatted the backs of my thighs with one of her shoes.
"Oliver, won't you come in the water with me?"
I didn't trust that mischievous smile of hers at all, so I said, "Last time we went skinny dipping, I fell on the dock buck naked and spent the rest of the night face down on the couch with Alexander pulling splinters out of my ass." The others laughed exhaustively at my expense, and Richard let out a long wolf whistle. Meredith,
"Come on, somebody swim with me."
Alexander, "You can't keep your clothes on for 24 hours, can you?" Philippa, "Maybe if Rick could keep her happy, she wouldn't be such a slut around the rest of us." More laughter, more whistling. Richard gave Philippa a lofty sort of look and said,
"The lady doth protest too much, methinks."
She rolled her eyes and sat beside Alexander, who was busy crumbling weed into a cigarette paper. I breathed in and held the sweet, woody air in my lungs for as long as I could. A sweltering summer in suburban Ohio had made me impatient to return to Delacre and the lake. The water was black by night, deep blue-green like jade by day. Dense forest surrounded it on all sides except one, the north shore, where the trees were thinner, and a strip of sandy white beach shimmered like diamond dust in the moonlight. On the south bank, we were just far enough away from the firefly lights of the hall that there was little danger of our being seen, and even less of being overheard. At the time, we liked our isolation. Meredith lay back, eyes closed, humming peacefully. James and Wren sat on the opposite edge of the dock, looking toward the beach. Alexander finished rolling his joint, lit it, and handed it to Philippa.
"Have a hit. We've got nothing to do tomorrow," he said, which wasn't entirely true.
We had our first real day of classes and convocation later in the evening. Nevertheless, she accepted the joint and took a long drag before passing it to me. We all indulged on special occasions, except Alexander, who was at least a little bit stoned all the time. Richard sighed, a sound of profound satisfaction that rumbled in his chest like a big cat's purr.
"This is going to be a good year," he said. "I can feel it."
Wren,
"Could that be because you've got the part you wanted?"
James,
"And half as many lines to learn as the rest of us?"
Richard,
"Seems fair after last year."
Me,
"I hate you."
Richard,
"Hatred is the sincerest form of flattery."
Alexander,
"That's imitation, dickhead."
A few of us snickered, still pleasantly buzzed. Our squabbling was good-natured and usually harmless. We had, like seven siblings, spent so much time together that we had seen the best and worst of one another and were unimpressed by either.
"Can you believe it's our last year?"
Wren said, when the lull after our laughter had lingered long enough.
"No," I said. "Seems like just yesterday my dad was shouting at me for throwing my life away."
Alexander snorted.
What was it he said to you?
You're going to turn down a scholarship at Case Western and spend the next 4 years in makeup and pantyhose, making love to some girl through a window? Art school alone was enough to provoke my rigidly practical father, but more often than not, Delacour's dangerous exclusivity was the cause of raised eyebrows. Why should intelligent, talented students risk forcible ejection from their school at the end of each year and graduate without even a traditional degree to show for their survival? What most people who lived outside the strange sphere of conservatory education didn't realize was that a Delacour certificate was like one of Willy Wonka's golden tickets, guaranteed to grant the bearer admission to the elite artistic and philological sodalities that survived outside academia. My father, even more staunchly opposed than most, refused to accept my decision to waste my university years. Acting was bad, but something so niche and old-fashioned as Shakespeare, at Delacour we didn't do anything else, was exponentially worse. 18 and vulnerable, I'd felt for the first time the extraordinary dread of wanting something desperately and watching it slip through my fingers, so I took the risk of telling him I would go to Delacour or nowhere. My mother persuaded him to pay my tuition, after weeks of ultimatums and circular arguments, on the grounds that my elder sister was on her way to failing out of Ohio State, and they were relying on me to be the one they bragged about at dinner parties. Why they didn't have higher hopes for Leah, the youngest and most promising of us, was a mystery.
"I wish my mother had been so furious," Alexander said. "She still thinks I'm at school in Indiana."
Alexander's mother had given him up for foster care at an early age and made only the barest efforts to stay in touch. All she'd deigned to tell him about his father was that the man was either from Puerto Rico or Costa Rica. She couldn't remember which, and had no idea Alexander existed. His tuition was paid by an extravagant scholarship and a small heap of money left to him by a dead grandfather, who had only done it to spite his own profligate offspring.
"My dad's just disappointed I wasn't a poet," James added.
Professor Farrow taught the Romantic poets at Berkeley, and his much younger wife, scandalously a former student, was a poet herself until she suffered a Plath-like breakdown when James was in grade school. I'd met them 2 summers before when I visited him in California, and had my suspicions that they were interesting people but disinterested parents unequivocally confirmed.
"My parents don't give a damn," Meredith said. "They're busy with Botox and tax evasion, and my brothers are taking good care of the family fortune."
The Dardennes split their time between Montreal and Manhattan, sold fantastically expensive wristwatches to politicians and celebrities, and treated their only daughter more like a novelty pet than a member of the family. Philippa, who never spoke about her parents, said nothing.
"A little more than kin and less than kind," Alexander said. "My God, our families are miserable."
"Well, not all of them," Richard said.
His and Wren's parents were 3 seasoned actors and a director living in London, making frequent appearances in the West End theaters. He shrugged.
"Our parents are thrilled."
Alexander exhaled a stream of smoke and flicked his spliff away.
"Lucky you," he said, and shoved Richard off the dock.
He hit the water with a monstrous splash, which sent water crashing over all of us. The girls squealed and threw their arms over their heads, while James and I yelped in surprise. A moment later, we were all sopping wet, laughing and applauding Alexander, too loud to hear Richard swearing when his head burst through the surface again. We lingered by the water for another hour before, one by one, we began the slow climb back to the castle. I was the last man standing on the dock. I didn't believe in God, but I asked whoever was listening not to let Richard's prediction jinx us. A good year was all I wanted. Scene 5. 8 in the morning was far too early for Gwendolyn.
We sat in a ragged circle, legs folded like storybook Indians, yawning and clutching mugs of coffee from the refectory. Studio 5, Gwendolyn's lair, festooned with colorful tapestries and cluttered with scented candles, was on the second floor of the hall. There was no furniture to speak of, but instead a generous collection of floor pillows, which only increased the temptation to stretch out and sleep. Gwendolyn arrived her usual quarter after the hour, fashionably late, she always told us, swathed in a spangled shawl, gold rings thick as knuckle dusters gleaming on her fingers. She was brighter than the pale morning sun outside and almost painful to look at. "Good morning, darlings," she trilled. Alexander grunted half a greeting, but nobody else replied. She stopped, standing over us, hands on her bony hips. "Well, this is just shameful. It's your first day of class. You ought to be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed." We stared at her until she flung her hands up and said, "On your feet. Let's go." The next half hour was devoted to a series of painful yoga positions. Gwendolyn, for a woman in her 60s, was disturbingly limber. As the minute hand inched toward the 9, she straightened up from her king pigeon pose with an ecstatic sigh that must have made someone besides me uncomfortable. "Isn't that better?" she said. Alexander grunted at her again. "I'm sure you've all missed me over the summer," she continued, "but we'll have plenty of time to catch up after convocation, so I'd like to dive right in and let you know that things are going to work a little differently this year." For the first time, the class, besides Alexander, showed signs of life. We shifted, sat up straighter, and began to really listen. "So far, you've been in the safe zone," Gwendolyn said, "and I feel it's only fair to warn you that those days are no more." I looked sideways at James, who frowned. I couldn't tell if she was being her usual dramatic self or if she really meant to make a change. "You know me by now," she said. "You know how I work. Frederick will coax and cajole you all day long, but I'm a pusher. I pushed you and pushed you, but," she held up one finger, "never too far." I didn't entirely agree. Gwendolyn's teaching methods were merciless, and it wasn't unusual for students to leave her class in tears. Actors were like oysters, she explained when anyone wanted justification for this emotional brutality. You had to crack their shells and break them open to find the precious pearls inside. She plowed ahead. "This is your last year, and I'm going to push you as far as I have to. I know what you're capable of, and I'll be damned if I don't drag it out of you by the time you leave this place." I shared another nervous look, this time with Philippa. Gwendolyn adjusted her shawl, smoothed her hair, and said, "Now, who can tell me what is our biggest impediment to good performance?" "Fear," Ren said. It was one of Gwendolyn's many mantras. "On the stage, you must be fearless." "Yes. Fear of what?"
"Vulnerability," Richard said.
"Precisely," Gwendolyn said. "We're only ever playing 50% of a character. The rest is us, and we're afraid to show people who we really are. We're afraid of looking foolish if we reveal the full force of our emotions. But in Shakespeare's world, passion is irresistible, not embarrassing. So," she clapped her hands, and the sound made half of us jump, "we banish the fear beginning today. You can't do good work if you're hiding, so we're going to get all of the ugliness out in the open. Who's first?" We sat in surprised silence for a few seconds before Meredith said, "I'll go." "Perfect," Gwendolyn said. "Stand up." I eyed Meredith uneasily as she climbed to her feet. She stood in the middle of our little circle, shifting her weight from foot to foot until she found her balance, tucking her hair out of the way behind her ears, her usual method of centering herself. We all had one, but few of us could make it look so effortless.
Meredith, Gwendolyn said, smiling up at her. Our guinea pig. Breathe.
Meredith swayed on the spot as if at the push and pull of a breeze, eyes closed, lips slightly parted. It was strangely relaxing to watch, and at the same time, strangely sensual.
There, Gwendolyn said. Are you ready?
Meredith nodded and opened her eyes.
Lovely. Let's start with something easy. What is your greatest strength as a performer?
Meredith, normally so confident, hesitated.
Gwendolyn. Your greatest strength?
Meredith.
I guess. Gwendolyn. No guessing. What is your greatest strength?
Meredith.
I think.
Gwendolyn. I don't want to hear what you think. I want to hear what you know. I don't care if you sound stuck up. I care what you're good at. And as a performer, you need to be able to tell me. What is your greatest strength?
I'm physical, Meredith said. I feel everything with my whole body, and I'm not afraid to use it. You're not afraid to use it, but you're afraid to say what you really mean.
Gwendolyn was nearly shouting. I glanced back and forth between them, alarmed at how quickly things had escalated.
You're tiptoeing around it because we're all sitting here staring at you, Gwendolyn said. Now out with it. Out!
Meredith's easy elegance was gone, and instead she stood with her legs locked, arms held rigidly at her sides.
I have a great body, she said, because I work fucking hard at it. I love looking this way, and I love people looking at me, and that makes me magnetic. You're damn right it does.
Gwendolyn leered at her like the Cheshire Cat.
You're a beautiful girl. It sounds bitchy, but you know what? It's true. More important than that, it's honest.
She jabbed one finger at her.
That was honest. Good.
Philippa and Alexander both fidgeted, avoiding Meredith's eyes. Richard was looking at her like he wanted to rip her clothes off on the spot, and I had no idea where to look. She nodded and made to sit back down, but Gwendolyn said,
You're not done.
Meredith froze.
We've established your strengths. Now I want to hear about your weaknesses. What are you most afraid of?
Meredith stood glowering at Gwendolyn, who, to my surprise, didn't interrupt the silence. The rest of us squirmed on the floor, eyes flicking up at Meredith with a mixture of sympathy, admiration, and embarrassment.
Everyone has a weakness, Meredith, Gwendolyn said. Even you. The strongest thing you can do is admit it.
We're waiting. In the excruciating pause that followed, Meredith stood impossibly still, eyes burning acid green. She was so exposed that staring at her seemed invasive, voyeuristic, and I grappled with the impulse to yell at her to just fucking say something.
I'm afraid,
she said, after what felt like a year, speaking very slowly,
that I'm prettier than I am talented or intelligent, and that because of that, no one will ever take me seriously, as a performer or a person.
Dead silence again. I forced my eyes down, glanced around at the others. Wren sat with one hand over her mouth. Richard's expression was softer than I had ever seen it. Philippa looked slightly nauseous. Alexander was fighting back a nervous grin. On my right, James peered up at Meredith with keen, evaluative interest as if she were a statue, a sculpture, something shaped 1,000 years ago in the likeness of a pagan deity. Her unmasking was harsh, mesmeric, somehow dignified. In a weird, bewildered way, I understood that this was exactly what Gwendolyn wanted.
She held Meredith's gaze so long it seemed like time had stopped. Then she exhaled enormously and said, "Good. Sit. There." Meredith's knees bent mechanically, and she sat in the center of the circle, spine straight and stiff as a fence post. "All right," Gwendolyn said. "Let's talk." Scene 6. After an hour of interrogating Meredith about her insecurities, of which there were more than I ever would have guessed, Gwendolyn dismissed us, with the promise that everyone else would be subjected to the same rigorous questioning over the next 2 weeks. On our way up the stairs to the third floor, second-year art students bustling around us on their way down to the conservatory, James fell in step beside me.
"That was ruthless," I said sotto voce.
Meredith walked a few steps ahead of us, Richard's arm around her shoulders, though she didn't seem to have noticed it. She moved determinedly forward, avoiding direct eye contact with anyone.
"Again," James whispered. "That's Gwendolyn."
I never thought I'd say this, but I'm looking forward to being shut in the gallery for 2 hours straight. While Gwendolyn taught the more visceral elements of acting, voice and body, heart over head, Frederick taught the intimate particulars of Shakespeare's text, everything from meter to early modern history. Bookish and diffident as I was, I much preferred Frederick's classes to Gwendolyn's, but I was allergic to the chalk he used on his blackboard and spent most of my time in the gallery sneezing.
"Let's go," James said quietly, "before Meredith steals our table."
Philippa had coined that particular term at the end of our second year when the two of them were newly in love and at their most obnoxious. Meredith's expression was still distracted as we edged past them on the stairs. Whatever Richard had said to soothe her, it wasn't working. Frederick preferred to conduct fourth-year classes in the gallery rather than the classroom he was forced to use for the more numerous second and third years. It was a narrow, high-ceilinged room that had once stretched the entire length of the third floor, but was unceremoniously divided into smaller rooms and studios when the school opened. The long gallery became the short gallery, barely 20 feet from end to end, walled on two sides with bookshelves and dotted with portraits of long-dead Delacour cousins and offspring. A love seat and a low-slung sofa faced each other under the elaborate plasterwork ceiling, while a small round table and two chairs basked in the light of the diamond-paned window on the south side of the room. Whenever we had tea with Frederick, which we did twice a month as third years and daily during class as fourth years, James and I made a beeline for the table. It was farthest from the nefarious chalk dust and offered a sparkling view of the lake and surrounding woods, the conical tower roof perched on top of the trees like a black party hat. Frederick was already there when we arrived, wheeling the chalkboard out from an odd little spear closet wedged between a bookshelf and the noseless bust of Homer at the end of the room. I sneezed as James said, "Good morning, Frederick." He looked up from the blackboard.
"James," he said. "Oliver, lovely to have you both back. Pleased with casting?"
"Absolutely," James said, but there was a note of wistfulness in his voice that puzzled me. Who would be disappointed to be playing Brutus? Then I remembered his remark from 2 nights previous about wanting a little more variety on his resume.
"When's our first rehearsal?" he asked.
"Sunday." Frederick winked. "We thought we'd give you a week to settle back in."
Because of their unsupervised residence in the castle and their infamous penchant for overindulgence, the fourth-year theater students were generally expected to throw some kind of kickoff party at the beginning of the year. We had planned it for Friday. Frederick and Gwendolyn and probably even Dean Holinshed knew about it, but gamely pretended not to. Richard and Meredith finally came in from the hall, and James and I hurried to dump our things on the table. I sneezed again, wiped my nose on a tea napkin, and peered out the window. The grounds were soaked in sunlight,
the lake rippling gently at the touch of a breeze. Richard and Meredith sat on the smaller sofa, leaving the other for Alexander and Philippa to share. They no longer bothered to leave room for Wren, who, endearingly, like a child excited for story time, preferred to sit on the floor. Frederick poured tea at the sideboard so the room smelled, as it always did, of chalk and lemon and Ceylon. When he had filled 8 cups, tea drinking in Frederick's class was mandatory, honey was encouraged, but milk and sugar were contraband, he turned around and said, "Welcome back." He twinkled down at us like a bookish little Santa Claus. "I enjoyed your auditions yesterday, and I'm eager to work with you again this semester." He passed the first teacup to Meredith, who passed it to Richard, who passed it to James, and so on, until it ended up in Wren's hands.
"Fourth year. The year of the tragedy," Frederick said grandly, when the tea tray was empty and everyone had a cup and saucer. Drinking tea from mugs, we were often reminded, was like drinking fine wine from a solo cup. "I will refrain from telling you to take the tragedies any more seriously than the comedies. In fact, one might argue that comedy must be deadly serious to the characters, or it is not funny for the audience. But that is a conversation for another time." He took his own teacup off the tray, sipped delicately, and set it down again. Frederick had never had a desk or a lectern, and instead paced slowly back and forth in front of the blackboard as he taught. "This year, we will devote our attention to Shakespeare's tragic plays. What might that course of study encompass, do you think?" I sneezed as if in response to his question, and there was a brief pause before we began suggesting topics. Alexander: "Source material." Philippa:
"Structure."
Wren:
"Imagery."
Meredith:
"Conflict, internal and external."
Me: "Fate versus agency." James:
"The tragic hero."
Richard:
"The tragic villain."
Frederick held up a hand to stop us. "Good. Yes," he said. "All of those things. We will, of course, touch on each of these plays, Troilus and Cressida and other problem plays included, but naturally we will begin with Julius Caesar. A question: why is Caesar not a history play?" James was first to answer with characteristic academic eagerness.
"The history plays are confined to English history."
"Indeed," Frederick said, and resumed his pacing. I sniffed, stirred my tea, and sat back in my chair to listen. "Most of the tragedies include some element of history, but what we choose to call history plays, as James has said, are truly English history plays, and are all named after English monarchs. Why else? What makes Caesar, first and foremost, a tragedy?" My classmates exchanged curious glances, unwilling to offer the first hypothesis and risk being wrong. "Well," I ventured when nobody else spoke, my voice thick with congestion, "by the end of the play, most of the major characters are dead, but Rome is still standing." I stopped, struggling to articulate the idea. "I think it's more about the people and less about the politics. It's definitely political, but if you look at it next to, I don't know, the Henry VI cycle, where everybody's just fighting over the throne, Caesar's more personal. It's about the characters and who they are, not just who's in power." I shrugged, unsure of whether I'd managed to make any part of my point. "Yes, I think Oliver is on to something," Frederick said. "Permit me to pose another question. What is more important, that Julius Caesar is assassinated, or that he is assassinated by his intimate friends?" It wasn't the sort of question that needed an answer, so no one replied. Frederick was watching me, I realized, with the proud, fatherly affection he usually reserved for James, who gave me a faint but encouraging smile when I glanced across the table. "That," Frederick said, "is where the tragedy is."
He looked around at all of us, hands folded behind his back, the midday sunlight glinting on his glasses.
So, shall we begin?
He turned to the blackboard, took a piece of chalk from the tray, and began to write. Act 1, Scene 1. A street. We open with the tribunes and the commoners. What do you suppose is significant about that? The cobbler has a battle of wits with Flavius and Marellus, and upon further questioning introduces our eponymous hero tyrant. We rummaged around in our bags to find notebooks and pens, and as Frederick carried on, we scribbled down almost his every word. The sun warmed my back, and the bittersweet scent of black tea drifted up into my face. I stole furtive glances at my classmates as they wrote, and listened and occasionally posed questions, struck by how lucky I was to be among them.